Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Today we convene the Science Forum, and we've gathered a great panel of science experts to respond to your questions and comments. The number to call here is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Now, you can also post your comments to today's Vox Pop wall post on our Facebook page, facebook.com/WAMC Radio. You can tweet your questions and comments at WAMC Radio. Just use the hashtag Vox Pop. Or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But by far the most popular thing to do on a call-in show is call, and that number is 1-800-348-2551. So let's meet our panel of experts.
Helen Girardella, Department of Biology, the University at Albany.
Hello, Helen.
Hello.
Nice to have you here.
Ray, you look so nice today.
Thank you.
Barbara Brabets, SUNY Cobleskill, Biochemistry.
Thanks, Barbara.
Ed Stander, Geology, Astronomy, anything Barbara can't answer, and I'll also take your questions by telepathy as necessary.
Really?
Yes, I can pick them up mentally now.
Okay. All right.
I hope you can't pick up what I'm thinking right now.
All right. Off to a flying start.
Now,
Barbara, you had mentioned that you had some homework.
I have homework. Our wonderful listeners and callers stumped the panel a bit the last time I was on.
Okay.
We'll blame Ed and me.
Usually blame Ed.
And it was about colony collapse disorder. They had asked about the declining bee population and what role the pesticides played in that.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons why I'll blame
me.
Others,
blame
why
me.
We didn't know, is because it's really not well understood how the neonicotinoids, also called the neonics, influence the bees.
Mm-hmm.
But I did do my homework, and that's what I love about this place. I like doing my homework for this show. What I came up with is that our White House has a task force on the pollinator health issue.
Ah.
And they recently released a report. It's a 64-page executive summary. So I read 64 pages back in May. But anyway, if you look through the literature, it really comes down to a complex of issues. The number one, which we discussed here, are mites that suck on the quote-unquote blood of bees and weaken them.
Mm-hmm.
Habitat loss, always a biggie. And then habitat fragmentation plays a primary role as well. So you've got a bunch of flowering plants in one place, then a road or an apartment complex, and then another bunch, and it breaks up the habitat, so the bees have to go farther
yeah.
to find their food.
Okay.
Global temperature increasing seems to have a particular issue here, especially when it comes to recently bumblebees.
Mm-hmm.
And that because these neonics are similar to nicotine in structure, they seem to have an addictive effect upon the bees.
Ah.
So the bees are seeking out the cultivated products, the corn, the soy, the citrus, that have these sprayed on them, and so they don't end up with as diverse a forage. So they're going for their cigarette before they're going for their veggies.
Interesting.
Is that why I'm addicted to honey?
Who knows, Ed? Who knows?
That's an interesting question as well. And the number to call here is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Well, while we wait for the calls to come in, what's new in the world of your fields of science? Anybody want to jump in here? Okay, number to call is 1-800-348-2551.
I've got more on the bees, Ray.
Oh, keep
more
going.
On the bees.
Oh, by all means, we got time.
So in mid-July, just a week ago, Science Magazine, one of the premieres, published a report about bumblebees. And what they did is they looked at bumblebee populations before 1974 and then from 1974 to present. And what they found is with the increasing atmospheric temperatures, the southern range of bumblebees has shrunk.
Ah.
They can't take the heat. However, they are not expanding their northern range, unlike other animals that are adapting to global climate change.
Now why is that, I wonder?
They don't know, but they speculate, which is the best we can do when we don't know. And they say that bees evolved in temperate climates, and so they don't have that ability to adapt as well as other cousins of theirs, like butterflies, that came up in tropical climates.
Mm.
So they can't take the heat, and they don't know to move.
Fascinating.
Yeah. So
I'm wondering if day length might have anything to do with
yeah,
it.
Yeah,
because it's more extreme north In terms of seasonal variation.
Sure, and a temperate, you'd want to have right. some variability in day length, right. but not a lot. And the day length may be a trigger for looking for flowering plants,
right, yeah.
and they could be there but just not survive. But they're just not finding that the bees are migrating north with the temperature change in climate.
All right, let's go to our telephone line at 1-800-348-2551. Let's see, it's Jane. Hi, Jane, you're on.
Hi. Oh, all right, thank you for taking my call. My husband told me recently he'd read that there's over 20,000 artificial satellites going around the Earth.
Yeah.
And, on a night here at my own place, we could see 6 to 7 in just a short amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
But when we see a falling star now, how frequent is that a piece of space debris, or is it a piece of garbage? Are we seeing asteroids, or are we seeing, junk from space debris?
Both, right?
Well, about 11,000 tons of asteroid material come into the atmosphere every day.
Every day?
Every day.
Wow.
And
most of them are about the size of a grain of sand.
Right.
So it's a very, very small thing. And they usually come in at about 400 miles per second, hit the atmosphere, burn up very, very quickly at about mm-hmm. 50 miles up. So the vast majority of what you see is asteroidal material. It's meteorites, meteor material.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty rare that a piece from a satellite actually hits. There is a new website, and I should get the name of it, that actually shows where all the satellites and their detritus is. And when you see it,
oh.
it looks like the entire planet is just covered with this stuff. But most of it just goes around in orbit, and it's very rare that it gets far enough down to get into the atmosphere to actually do damage.
Are these pieces, Ed?
Oh, the pieces, like the meteorite material?
I was thinking more of the man-made satellite pieces.
The man-made satellite, yeah.
Oh, they can get pretty big. I actually saw a couple of them come down at various times. When they do come into the atmosphere, they usually move relatively slow, and you can actually see pieces dropping off of them as they come into the atmosphere. So they look very, very different from meteoroids that are
so
moving very,
almost,
very, very fast as they come in.
You mean so they would almost like sparks would almost come off it?
Yeah, it's almost as if they're melting. You can see pieces of them come off, things like that. So it's a very, very different thing when they do come in like that, because they're moving at about the same speed as the Earth as compared to the meteoroids that are moving much faster.
Yeah, I wasn't worried about damage as much as just trying to identify, seeing a shooting star, or am I seeing shooting garbage?
Well, shooting garbage usually goes across the sky a lot slower, and it lasts a lot longer.
Jane, thanks a lot.
Great. Well, thank you very much.
Bye now.
Can you imagine wishing on, shooting garbage as opposed to shooting star?
That's an idea for a song. Ron in Hyde Park. Ron, you're on.
Yeah, if I remember my early physics, I think the laws of thermodynamics, one of them says that energy can either be destroyed or created. How do we come about with the Big Bang? I mean, what happened? How do we create nothing from something, or something from nothing?
Well,
I'm having a hard time making that jump.
Actually, none of us in the room have the answer to that, because very few of us were here at the time. But
okay.
I would mention that some people suggest that the universe started in another dimension. And pieces of that dimension came into our dimension, so that effectively material is being moved from one dimension to another dimension. So nothing's being created or destroyed even on that level.
How are you going to prove that one?
I'm
going to wait till somebody
do it
else does.
Telepathically is what he's going to
oh,
do.
Oh, telepathically. Oh,
yes,
well played, Ron. Yes.
They're called brains, BRANES, for membranes. And the idea is that sometimes one of these membranes hits a spot in the universe where it's able to get into another universe, and that becomes the part that becomes the Big Bang. That, believe it or not, is one of the reigning theories as to how it all started. But
it's like string theory. How do you test it?
It's a difficult thing to prove. Even my teachers weren't around back then, so I can't really tell you.
The other thing that I've read, and I am not a physicist, is that the laws of physics that we know right now are really the new laws of physics that are about 10 seconds after the universe exploded from the Big Bang. That's when our rules seem to go back to. So for those first few seconds of the Big Bang, we're not sure. It's math. It's crazy that the math doesn't go all the way back to the Big Bang, that there's a little truncated piece that we can't explain, and that might mean that the speed of light was different, that the laws of conservation of energy and mass may have been different for those first few seconds of the Big Bang.
Yeah, what we do is we take we go back to places like Switzerland, where we have the giant atom smashers, and we keep on putting more and more energy in there. And as we get more and more energy, we're going closer and closer to what would have been the Big Bang, if you will. And the closest we've gotten, I think, is 10 to the minus 31 seconds.
Okay.
And prior to that, we don't know what was going on. But there is something to consider, and that's this crazy idea that energy is equal to mass squared by the speed of light squared, which means that early on, we didn't have mass, we had energy. And then as the universe expanded and cooled, effectively mass was produced. So you could have a lot of mass on the head of a pin, which allows you to have a Big Bang. And that's the best we can do right now.
All right. Well, I'll tell you what we can do right now. We can take a break. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum, and we will be back.
Support for WAMC comes from Interim Healthcare, providing companions, aides, and nurses in the home 2 to 24 hours a day so you or a loved one can stay in your home. Supporting the Mohawk Hudson Land Conservancy, interimhealthcare.com. The Henyon Bakery, Amherst, since 1993, offering hearth-baked whole-grain breads, pastries, birthday, wedding, and special occasion cakes, as well as gluten-free offerings, henyonbakery.com. SPAC, hosting the Philadelphia Orchestra with 12 performances featuring modern to classic with musicians from around the world, August 5th to the 22nd, SPAC.org for tickets. Rogers Book Barn, Hillsdale, New York, a bookstore on a country road with 30,000 used books and classical CDs, open 11 to 5, Thursday to Monday, rogersbookbarn.com. Valley Home Improvement, designing and building kitchens, bathrooms, interiors, and additions throughout the Pioneer Valley. Love your home, valleyhomeimprovement.com. And Quality Foreign Car Care, Ballston Spa, New York, specializing in European car sales and service for over 20 years, qfcc.com.
Vox Pop on WAMC. 1-800-348-2551 is the telephone number. It's the Science Forum. And boy, what a great panel we have today. Let's see if I can remember their names. Helen and Barbara and Ed. And I'm Ray, and you're on the phone. And let's go to someone named Dawn in Delmar. Dawn, you're on.
Hi. I was sitting on my deck in the suburbs about a week ago.
Yeah.
And I heard a snap of like a branch because I have a wooded area. And then I heard a growling sound near the deck. And I was terrified because it wasn't like a dog. You know, any dogs in the neighborhood I would know. And it happened twice. And I'm just wondering if anybody has any ideas about what it could possibly have been.
Yeah, I'll take this one. It was my kids, I'm sure.
Experienced
well, keep
in
them out of my yard.
Yes. All right, I'll keep them out of your yard.
So, Dawn, can I channel click and clack here and ask you to simulate the sound?
Oh, I love this. Thanks, Barbara.
Oh boy. I'm going to try, but that sort of. Did you hear it?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, not really Rory, much more guttural.
Yes.
Don't we have coyotes out that way?
Yeah, but they don't growl like that.
No?
They tend to yip a lot more than anything else.
Uh-huh.
I'm actually going to go with our good old suburban raccoon.
Yes.
Okay.
And they're probably not growling at you. They compete for territory. And
okay.
The big males come in and try to bust a move for a food source. And the females get very territorial, especially with the babies around.
Yeah,
what about an opossum?
They hiss more than they growl.
Okay. All right. So a raccoon, I don't really have to be afraid of that.
Oh, yes, you do.
They're wily ones. Anyone who knows me knows I have raccoon stories up the yin-yang. But we've been sitting watching TV late at night, like Jon Stewart or something. Not public television, sorry. At at 11, and we'll hear the swish of the cat door, but then we'll look and we'll count the cats in front of us and know that there's been an additional member of the family, and he's sneaking to the kitchen, which is not a trivial distance, in order to get to the food bowl, and it's a raccoon.
Boy. We'll all be dipped. Yeah. That's amazing. Well, I remember that they do have sharp, pointy teeth.
Yes, and pretty nasty saliva.
All right. Well, I have a gate around my deck, so I feel pretty safe.
Okay.
Right? They're not going to, like, leap or crawl under the gate, do you think?
They're only going to be after an ice cream cone or some dog food. They're not going to be after you. You're not tasty to them.
Or you could leave a garbage
close,
can
though.
Nearby.
Leave a garbage can nearby?
Garbage can nearby. No, like, they'll tip it over, and then you know they're there.
I see.
What's that?
Well, Ed had a kind of a cheeky response here. He said you can leave a garbage can nearby, and if they knock it over, then you'll know they're nearby.
And that it's a raccoon, too.
Right.
A possum can't do that.
Oh, okay.
Thanks
Very
a lot.
Good. Thank
appreciate
you.
The call. I remember when I was a kid, we had a raccoon that was in our garage, and I grew up in Del Mar. And my father said, I'm going to get them, going to get this thing out of here. And he took a push broom, and he went toward the raccoon, and the raccoon bit the broomstick in half.
Oh, jeez.
That's when we called animal control.
Yeah. I've been asked many times, why don't I have my raccoons eliminated? I'm doing air quotes on radio. And the thing is, there's another raccoon going to move in the territory.
Yeah.
So I might as well have a detente, if you will.
Yeah.
Not fill the bird feeders until they go to sleep in the wintertime, which they kind of do.
You know, it's verifying the treaties with the raccoons that's the real difficult part.
Trust but verify.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
A number to call here is 1-800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum. Now, Jim, who didn't stay on the line, wanted to know, can you get a sunburn through glass?
That's a great question. We've had this one before, but I've been asked this many times. It turns out you really can't, because most auto glass and home glass has a UV filter in it. So it specifically filters out ultraviolet rays, which are the rays that cause sunburn. So if you have an old-fashioned house with old-fashioned pane glass, perhaps you can.
Okay.
But modern glass, and I mean like glass in the last 80 years or so, filters UV, and especially in cars.
So cocktail glass, you could probably get a sunburn through.
Yeah.
So in other words, glass itself doesn't have a property that filters the UVs. It needs to have that added to it.
Pretty much, yes. Yes.
And the reason for it is not to stop sunburns, but to stop fading of pictures and fading of rugs and things like that. So they're just doing it secondarily.
Right. Nobody likes a couch that's faded on one side.
1-800-348-2551. Let's go to Doug in Warren, Massachusetts. Doug.
Yeah. Just a very quick comment. Ted had made a comment about a website where you could track satellites in your area. The site is heavens-above.com.
Yep.
You enter in your zip code, it'll locate you, and you can find out anything in the sky, day or night.
And you can click on it, and it'll tell you what it is, and how big it is, and what debris is coming in, and all the rest of it. It's
amazing.
Everything.
Yeah, great.
Gotta love
the web. It's frightening, actually, if you look at it.
Gotta love the web.
Thanks, Doug.
Oh, okay, you're welcome. Bye-bye.
Appreciate it. Except for, I presume, the classified satellites.
It pretty well describes everything, including all the Chinese satellites.
You're kidding me.
It's all there, and there's 10,000 of them. And you can type in, for example, GPS, and it'll just show you all the GPS satellites that are in space.
So the GPS satellites are how far out? Are they in geosynchronous? No, they're not,
they're
are
geosynchronous,
they? They are. So 22,000 miles?
No. Not geosynchronous with the sun, geosynchronous with the Earth.
Well, it would be, that
they're
would be 22,000 miles, right?
No, they're not that high up. I can't remember exactly how high, but they're 230, 250 miles up. That's about it.
They're above the space station, I know that.
Okay. So well, then how can they be geosynchronous if they're not that far out, right?
Because they move with the Earth.
Oh, but they do it using power.
Right.
Okay. Number to call here is 1-800-348-2551. Let's go to line 2 and Nancy in Wilton. Nancy.
Hi. I actually have two questions. Could I ask two questions?
Well, okay.
Real quick.
All right.
One is we live in just outside of Wilton, very little town near Saratoga. You were talking about raccoons. We don't have raccoons here.
Really?
And I'm from the Midwest, and we have an abundance of raccoons. And I said to my husband, I mean, we're surrounded by trees here and everything. I said, how come you don't have any raccoons?
That's very interesting. So I'll take my little sociological experiment in my yard. Now, I live in the town of Florida, which is not in Florida.
No.
It's in the town of Florida, which is just outside Amsterdam. Very rural, but yet it's agrarian. So you get kind of that fringe between populated space where you have grains and mice and so on and so forth, and then real woods where you don't have anything but woods and the wildlife that goes with it. And our raccoon population will fluctuate, and it has to, and in fact, our raccoons disappeared for about a year, and then we realized we had a fisher, and a fisher cat sometimes it's called. It's one of the largest members of the weasel family, and they are highly aggressive territorial predators. And so they had been like the police of my neighborhood and cleaned out any competition. Their primary diet is porcupine, but you can understand that if you can take on a porcupine, you can take on a raccoon. And so we have now set up a trail cam to try to see if the fishers are there, if they're back, because the raccoons are obviously in my kitchen. And no sign of the fisher, and we have porcupine back on the property. So I think the fishers moved on, and now we're back. So if you have top predators, coyotes and raccoons can live together, but they do tend to fight. But fisher cat are really territorial.
How big is a fisher cat?
It's like 22 pounds. But when you see a wild animal, 22 pounds, it looks bigger than a domestic cat. But if you Google pictures, people will say, oh, it looks like a domestic cat. Uh-uh. That thing's a lot scarier than
a domestic cat. But it's
really
of the weasel family?
It's a weasel.
Well, I'll be darned.
Yeah, well, again, I would suggest that you put out a garbage can so you can test whether there are raccoons or not. And put out some cameras as well.
Yeah, the wildlife cams, you can get one for $60 at any big box store or online. And they're really wonderful because you get to see which neighbor animals are coming to your house. You get to see your kids sneak out late at night. And you can see your fisher cat if you have one.
I like it. Well, good luck with that.
My neighbor has a camera at night that he watches. And he says he hasn't seen a raccoon in like 10 years. Mm-hmm. My second question, though, is one I'm really interested to hear. What about this crazy noise that supposedly people all around the world are hearing that comes from the sky, like
a
big booming noise?
Have you heard that?
And every time I see that, I want to know, what is it?
Well, it's all over the internet, and there are some questions about whether this is, in fact, some sort of elaborate viral hoax. But it's strange sort of trumpet-like noises that have allegedly been recorded ostensibly from the atmosphere around the world.
Trumpets?
Yeah, it's like Gabriel's trumpet. It's very spooky, but I have no proof that it is, in fact, real.
Don't know anything about it.
I've never heard anything.
Astronomer? What do you say?
I haven't heard it either, which is depressing.
Now, a NASA expert went so far as to speculate that it may be Earth noises. But I think it's dangerous to speculate when you don't even know if it's a real phenomenon. But yeah, that's good. Well, we'll follow that one. All right, Nancy?
All right. Okay, thanks.
Thanks a lot. Let's go over to Lois in Montgomery. Lois.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Love the show.
Thanks.
I have a question, or maybe just a comment.
All right.
I lived on Long Island for many years, and there are tons of raccoons out there. And then I lived in the Adirondacks also, but way up in Chestertown, and I never saw any there. But then when we came to Montgomery, I expected to see them here, and I've never seen one here, even with garbage cans out all over the place. Huh. And we have the state land right behind our house. But I do see something that my sister says are woodchucks.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
They're big, fat, brown things.
Mm-hmm.
Are those woodchucks?
They are.
They are. They're
Do they have any thing to do with our not having raccoons?
No, they're very pudgy herbivores, so they don't really compete with raccoons for territory.
Yeah, they just kind of flop around.
But we do have, we have had waves of raccoon rabies grow throughout the state, and I'm not sure if in the southern tier or down by Montgomery if raccoon rabies has made a comeback. But our turkey population upstate, even further, really rebounded well in the late 90s and early 2000s because the raccoons had taken a tumble because raccoon rabies had pretty much wiped them out, and the turkeys were able to survive.
So the raccoons like the turkey.
They like the turkey eggs, and they like the little turklets.
Oh, I'll be darned.
The pullets.
Oh, okay.
So it could be a wave of rabies. I just don't know. I'd have to ask our DEC friends if there's been a lot of raccoon rabies down by. Are you in Orange County?
Yeah. Right here. Yeah, no, I've never seen one.
Is that
I've only been here 2.5 years.
Lois, is that an official homework request?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. All right. She will research that. And Lois, thank you for the call. It's Vox Pop. It's the Science Forum. I guess the password today is raccoon.
No, please.
No. Let's go to John on the Northway. John, you're on.
Hi. Just a follow-up question to the UV car sunburn thing.
Yeah.
My understanding was that it wasn't ultraviolet light that gave you a sunburn. It was infrared that gave you a sunburn.
No, infrared is heat, but it doesn't give you a sunburn because it's not able to penetrate into your skin beyond the top surface.
No, the official, we call it UVA rays and UVB rays, and they have to do with high intensity and lower intensity UV rays. I did want to do a follow-up about the autoglass. If you have a sun sensitivity, like if you're taking certain drugs like doxycycline for Lyme disease, that sensitivity can still be in play through autoglass because it's not necessarily the UV light that's triggering the sensitivity. So you may still have to worry about sun, but not a sunburn.
Okay, thanks.
Hey, thanks a lot. We appreciate the call. Over to Portia in Leverett. Hiya, Portia.
Oh, hi. I'm actually calling because I've noticed this summer that there aren't as many crickets, and crickets are such a lovely... They sing so in such a lovely way every summer, and I haven't heard them. Sometimes I listen at night, and there's none. And usually there's just this pulsing chorus of these little critters, and I didn't know if there's an explanation or if anybody else has noticed.
Are you sure
it's
crickets
and not cicadas? Because there have been very few cicadas this year.
I think I know it's cicada. Well, maybe I don't, but this is the one. This is the sound. I mean, after the peepers, and then they stop, and then there's this really robust chorus of what I think of as little crickets, the little back and forth sound. I'm not going to try.
Oh, come on.
Reproduce? No, I'm not. I don't think I would know how to do that, but I certainly know how to listen to it and appreciate it, and I. Well, I spent many of my summers in the woods, and I've been always so pleased to hear them. And this summer, I really, sometimes I don't hear anything.
Well, from what I know, the difference between a cricket and cicada is that a cricket tends to start chirping and then stopping, while the cicada, it just goes on and on and on because it's just rubbing its feet together, I guess.
Okay.
Yeah, rubbing itself together.
I thought it was the other way around.
No, cicadas are constant. Last summer was a banner year for cicadas.
Yeah.
It was the 17-year cycle peak. And I actually recorded some cell phone video where I couldn't hear myself over the cicadas. It was so loud.
Okay, and what do the crickets sound like?
Meeny-neep. Meeny-neep.
Yep.
Meeny-neep.
Well, you're good.
Oh, she is. She's very good.
Yeah. But she's actually doing that with a telephone.
Yeah, I'm using a phone. No, I'm not.
Well, thank you, Portia.
All right. Well, I'm going to listen more carefully. Thank you.
Appreciate the call. You know what we've seen a lot of, and not in the last couple of days, but last week and the week before, lightning bugs.
Oh, absolutely.
So
beautiful.
Many of them. It was great.
This has been a banner season.
I think the wet spring and then the dry early summer really got them going because along with them comes a lot of mosquitoes, too.
Okay, what do they eat?
The lightning bugs?
Yeah.
They're plant matter, just plant matter.
That's very interesting because...
Well, unless you're a female photurist, in which case you eat meat as well.
Oh, really?
Because you're getting ready to do the deed.
Okay, I'm going to...
Oh, boy.
I'm going to grab
biology.
I'm going to grab the microphone here for just a second.
Oh, fine.
She'll flash like a female. The male will flash her species, and then she answers. And if they're compatible, they'll get together and they'll mate. And now she's got fertilized eggs. But she now starts flashing, she starts answering Photinus males, and they get closer and it's more interesting. You know, she seems to be a really sexy female.
Yeah.
And then she eats them. She lures them in by imitating the flash of the female of their species. So it's really a jungle out there.
Yeah, apparently. Now, interestingly, as we observed them over that peak period, couple of weeks where we really noticed them. Next door neighbor's yard, thousands of them.
Yeah.
My yard, not, you know, they abut each other and they're not very far apart. Not that many.
Huh. It may have to do with just the local moisture and things like that. Yeah. But we certainly have had them.
You don't treat your yard with any of those.
Absolutely not. Never.
Right.
And if you took a look at my yard, you'd know that I do not do that. So they're gone, though. Only a couple now.
Well, just a few, yeah.
Yeah, so what happened?
The season, well,
they've all been eaten by that lady?
If you go out and look very, very carefully in a little while or early in the spring, not yet, but you might see a pinpoint of light that gets brighter and then sinks, and that's brighter and then darker. These are the larvae, which also have lanterns.
Really?
Yeah.
Now, wouldn't that be a bad thing as an evolutionary sort of trait if you're a larvae and you don't move around too much and you have a light that says to other predators, hey, here I am, well, I'm lit up?
It depends on who I am. They're chemically protected.
Are they?
Meaning that if you eat me, you're going to be sick for 2 days. Don't even think of it.
Huh.
I've
so
never
it's
eaten
like,
them.
No?
No, I try to
I find that hard
them.
To believe.
It's true.
Well, that explains a few things.
I'm not very bright.
So there are...
Let me just finish
the
thought here.
Yeah, yeah, finish the thought and then
I'm
going
to... back to the callers. But the point is simply that this is one way... Yeah, it's like very, very bright colors on a snake. That's poisonous. Mm. It's a warning. Well, aposematic, we call it technically. I know I'm brilliant, I'm visible, and there's a reason that I'm advertising myself, because if you even think of eating me, or if you take a bite out of me, you're going to be sick.
Big mistake. Perfect spot for a break, Zach, on that disturbing note. 1-800-348-2551. We'll be back on the Science Forum, perhaps.
Support for WAMC comes from NBT Bank, offering trust and fiduciary services, investment management, and retirement planning for individuals and businesses. NBTBank.com. Pave, tile, wood, and stone, using French artisan techniques to manufacture pre-finished oak floors, decorative and terracotta tile, and importing aged French limestone, showroom by appointment and online. PAVETile.com. George Propane, Goshen, Massachusetts. Family-owned and operated for over 75 years, serving Western Massachusetts with propane and full-service heating and plumbing installation, services and deliveries, georgepropane.com. Ye Olde Warwick Bookshop, Warwick, New York, a Hudson River Valley bookseller specializing in new and vintage books, plus collectibles and curiosities, open 7 days a week, yeoldwarwickbookshop.com. Apex Solar Power, Queensbury, New York, locally owned, installing solar panels, solar hot water, solar pool heating, apexsolarpower.com for information. And the Whistling Kettle Tea Room, tea shops and cafes in Ballston Spa in downtown Troy, New York. Over 170 loose-leaf teas from around the world, in-store and online, thewhistlingkettle.com.
Vox Pop on WAMC, 1-800-348-2551, the Science Forum, and we'll get right back to the phones. Barbara, you had an event you want to mention.
I did. SUNY Cobleskill, where Ed and I work during the regular semester, has an instant admission, two instant admission days coming up. It's tomorrow, Thursday, and also Friday. And what this allows anyone who's considering going back into the fall and to school in the fall, or starting school this fall,
or taking my course,
or taking Dr. Stander or Professor Brovitz's courses, is you can register online to come on down to campus. You get an instant interview with an admissions decision, as long as you bring the required documents like your high school transcript, etc. You'll also meet with a member of our financial aid team, get tours, and we'll even sign you up for courses.
Well,
so you can do it all in one spot.
It's very exciting.
Yeah.
Oh, good.
So the website is cobleskill.edu/instant.
Okay. And let's go back to the phones. Felicia in Amherst. Felicia.
It's actually Elisa. But anyway,
oops,
thanks.
Sorry.
I'm calling again about crickets, because I think Portia and I don't live very far apart. And she said she hadn't heard any, and I felt like I was hearing them earlier than usual this year. I kept, because I think of crickets as summer, like mid to late July, and I was hearing them in late June. Hmm. So unless she and I have different understandings of what a cricket sounds like, I'm quite puzzled.
Interesting.
So.
That just is another one of those cool pieces about nature. We have to observe and then try to take nature's experiment and figure out what's going on.
Yeah.
Well, the weather has not been so predictable either.
No.
In other words, it was warm early, and that might have been one reason then.
Right.
It's a good year for mushrooms in any case.
Indeed it is. And that's a whole other show.
Other area.
Thank you, Alicia. Thank you for the call.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye now. And let's go to Tim, if that is in fact your name, in Boston Spa.
Yes.
You're on.
I just tuned in, so I don't know if you covered it, but my fruit trees, total lack of honeybees, but there were numerous other little pollinators, wasp-like, solitary bees, etc. And now I can look around my garden. All the tomatoes are flowering, and the squash and everything, and I don't see a single pollinating insect. I have a trumpet vine that is attracting a lot of small carpenter bees, but is this any kind of a trend that you notice?
Okay, panel.
Well, I unfortunately, from my homework that I did today, I have some disturbing statistics about pollinators in general and specifically managed bees. So if you look at commercial bee colonies that are hired to roam from agricultural field to agricultural field to help with the pollination, the records have been kept for over three decades, and the decline has been pretty consistent. But there was in 2013-2014, there was a 35% decline in the commercial honeybee population.
I know about them. I guess I'm most curious about the other little pollinators.
Well, they're harder to track because, you know, they're not as much of a factor that we can say we know how many we have to begin with. Now, there's USDA and EPA. Both organizations are engaged in research and engaged in giving grants to academic organizations to do research. But in Europe, where they restricted the use of these insecticides, these nicotine-like insecticides, they banned them a few years ago, but the colonies are still collapsing, both the wild and the livestock, if you will, honeybee populations are still collapsing. So it's not just a one-prong approach, but the collapse has not been arrested. If you look at the commercial, if you look at some of the wild bee populations, like bumbles, they're going up slightly, but they're not really sure what that's about. It could just be a glitch. It could be weather-related.
Tim, thanks a lot for the call. A number to call here on the Vox Pop Science Forum is 1-800-348-2551. Let's go to Glenn in Round Top. Glenn.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
This is a follow-up on the crickets thing. It's ironic because last night I was walking around. I said, gee, I don't hear any crickets at all. And you're usually going like crazy here in the evening. And it's just kind of strange that Portia had brought that up. Hmm. And also, right now, as I'm sitting here on my deck, I'm having little brown bats flying around. What is that all about?
In the daytime?
During the daytime, yeah.
Hmm.
Are you scared? Rabid?
I rabies was the first thing that came to my head because we're not at a shoulder season, so it's not fall and it's not spring, because then white nose tends to screw up their circadian rhythms. But bats, when they're rabid, do tend to blow the idea that they are, you know, diurnal, that they come out at dusk and go back at dawn. Did you have anything, Helen?
No.
Because they're right above my door as I walk in.
Oh, boy.
Well,
and they've been there for many years now.
Yeah. I think if you do find one that's discarded, or if one of your animals brings one, I would bag it and call your local Department of Health. Don't touch it without gloves.
Of course not. Yeah. Right.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks a lot. Now, how long would a rabid bat live?
A week.
So, I mean, if he's had them for years and they're doing the same thing, could there be another answer?
He didn't say that they were doing the same thing. He just said that he's had them around.
That he's had a colony of bats for years, but now they're out in the daytime.
That's a whole other story.
Well, we'll see. Nick and Byrne. Nick, you're on.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
I have a question about wolves. I know they've been making a comeback up in the Adirondacks, but a couple of weeks ago, we were out in our backyard having a fire, and we heard the coyotes, very distinct sound. I've known about them for years. But then we heard another howl that was quite different. And I was wondering if anybody had heard any reports of wolves making a comeback in that region, in the Helderbergs, Catskills or anything.
I haven't. There's a wolf study. One of our students is doing a wolf study, wolf/coyote study, with the New York State Museum this summer. That's his internship. I have not heard of any wolves. I've heard of them up by the St. Lawrence. That's about as close as they even get in the Adirondacks. There haven't been really any in the penetration of the Adirondacks proper, but rather on the fringes coming down across the river from Quebec.
Huh. It's really curious because, like I said, the coyote sound is very distinct, and this is very different.
Is there any way it could have been a domestic dog that got set off? Because
I mean, I suppose it could have been. There aren't many people around us, though, so.
Hmm. Could you record it next time?
I could. It was the only time that I've ever heard it. We only heard it the one night, and then haven't heard it since then. It was interesting, though.
Well, you know, wolves and coyotes are not friends. If you play like loudly, coyotes howling, you could perhaps prompt a response and be ready to tape it again.
Ooh, great idea.
That's interesting. I could do that. Yeah, I haven't heard the coyotes since then either, which is bizarre because I usually hear them all the time.
Well, Nick, that's a great call, and good luck with that mystery. 1-800-348-2551. Let's go to line 4 and Gordon and Kinderhook.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, and this question is not about raccoons, thank you.
Oh, fair enough.
Darn.
I hate to disappoint you. this question really is a simple question, maybe a simple answer, but it has to do with one of the five senses. But just a quick story. When I was a kid, we used to have haunted houses at my house. We invite kids down in the cellar, and we try to scare them, spook them, stuff like that. And one of the things we used to do was blindfold them, have them pinch their nose, and then we'd, like, put grapes in their mouth, and they start chewing. And because they couldn't taste them, we'd say, oh, they're eyeballs or something.
Yeah.
They'd scream and stuff like that. That's really sort of the premise of my question, and that is how, if you lose your sense of smell and hence don't have a sense of taste, or if taste is solely relying on the sense of smell, how is taste a sense? Because there's no other sense, at least, you know, I'm not a scientist, there's no other sense that I can think of, that relies on another sense to be effective. So if we lose the sense of smell, and then if we take away the sense of smell and we lose the sense of taste, why is the sense of taste a sense?
It's a great question.
I'm going to take a stab at it.
Okay.
We're dealing with chemical senses, and one of them overlaps the other, so to speak. But if something is easily airborne, then you're much more likely to smell it than you are to taste it. And those chemicals that are not airborne, that are not coming in through the nasal passages, are not going to be picked up by the nasal receptors. And so if you sense them at all, you're probably going to get them with receptors on the tongue and in the mouth. But most chemicals will have also, they're light enough so that they can be airborne, and so you'll pick up a fair amount of information.
Right.
With the nasal passage. I'm sorry?
Yeah, I mean, it is curious, though, because, I mean, I've, you know, had young kids at one point, and, you know, sometimes eating at dinner, you say, oh, just pinch your nose, plug your nose, and eat it anyway, because they don't like the taste of whatever.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But, and even if you do it yourself, I mean, you do deprive yourself, I think, for the most part, the sense of taste when you plug your nose. And so, I don't know, it's one of those questions that's always dogged me, and you know, your answer in terms of the sort of the chemical response with, you know, is probably part of the answer. But
well, it's really, yeah, I agree completely. I mean, but on the other hand, a lot of this is also how we use the language. It's a matter of definition.
Well, if you think, too, of the range of smells and flavors that we're able to distinguish, our vocabulary, if you will, of foods, it's vast. From the research I've read, you have very distinctive tastes that you can grab, but they have to be kind of jolting. So the sour, the
right.
super sweet, the super spicy,
right.
the bitters, those are the ones that your tongue can do without your nose anytime. But in order to get that full vocabulary of taste, that full breadth of taste, you need the olfactory cues to be able to hone in kind of the brute force flavors that your
right.
tongue can pick up.
And
correct.
The sensitivity
yeah.
of the two, the tongue is
right.
much, much less sensitive than the
absolutely,
than
the olfactory nerve.
Well, by definition, in other words, if it is volatile, then mm-hmm. the tongue may or may not pick it up. If it is not volatile, the tongue is more sensitive.
So you get that taste of cardboard, that like when your grandma says, I can't taste foods the way I used to,
yeah.
That's really an olfactory issue.
Okay.
Because you're back to kind of the blah taste of what tongue receives.
Fair enough. Let's go to Fred in Hudson. Fred, you're on.
Hi, I had a question about electromagnetism. Huh. Two parts. If an electromagnet is just, you know, charged but not holding anything, does it use less energy than when it's charged and something stuck to it? And also, where does a solid-state magnet, just a regular magnet, get the energy it uses to, like, stick to something indefinitely?
Well, in the first case, the electromagnet uses the same amount of energy whether it has something stuck to it or it doesn't have any stuck to it, because it's producing the same electromagnetic range around it, if you will, that would allow it to stick. In the second case, the regular magnet or a...
Ferromagnet
has domains within it in which effectively when you magnetize something, what you do is you align all the domains in the same direction so that it takes the charge of the magnet that was used to produce that orientation. So it's effectively a permanent magnet in that respect. Most materials will have domains of electromagnetism, but unless they're aligned, they negate each other. They just equal zero in the end.
But, I mean, in order to exert, you know, to defy gravity, it's using energy. Where is that energy coming from?
To defy gravity?
Yeah, let's say your refrigerator magnet's stuck to the fridge. Gravity's always pulling on it. It's resisting gravity, which is requiring some kind of energy, right?
Well, it's sticking to the metal, effectively, and it's...
It's a force, a sideways force versus a downward force, and the sideways force is greater than the downward force.
So it doesn't fall down.
Yeah.
Fred, thank you very much for the call. Over to Peter in Albany. Peter.
Good afternoon. I have a question. Are there any observatories in the area that are open to the public?
Huh.
Meaning free?
Yeah, you know, like one of the colleges have an observatory.
Well, actually, we at SUNY Copplesville do have an observatory. By next year, it will be available to the public. Still getting it operating.
Or anything?
What I would do is I'd contact the Albany Astronomical Association,
Area Amateur Astronomers.
Astronomers, and check with them. They do have meetings, and they bring out lots and lots of telescopes when they do. Usually it's at the...
Landis Arboretum in Esperance.
Wow. I like the way you answer everyone's sentences.
And they do this once a month or even more often sometimes. And they have a website, Dudley Observatory. You can check with them, and it will tell you where they are and when they're doing it.
Great. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much. Time for a quick call here. Pat in Boyceville. Pat.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to let you know the sound that someone described as a cricket, that dee dee dee, dee dee dee, that's not a cricket, that's a katydid.
Right, but I thought that's the one that was out now that she was missing.
And the katydids don't start usually until right around now, into August.
Right.
Right. That's why I didn't do that. That rub, 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 rub.
This show's falling apart.
I'm sorry. I apologize for
my unusual.
Hasn't it, Helen? This has been very odd. Well, Pat, thank you very much for calling. Oh, boy.
And on that note,
you're right, Pat.
We're almost done. Once again, your event coming up at Copplesville is tomorrow?
Tomorrow and Friday.
Okay.
If you go online, you can register for a time.
All right. And, well, gosh, this has been fun. Helen, have you had a good time?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yes.
You didn't say much today. I mean, you say a lot before we're on the air, and then you didn't say much today during the show.
Well, they didn't ask questions that were in my fields of...
Well, they don't ask questions that are in my field. Doesn't stop me from answering.
Boy, you got that right.
I've been meaning to comment on that, but yes. I didn't want to do it on the air.
Well, we are just about out of time, and I want to thank everybody who called in today, and those who were left on the line, I apologize, right?
Yes.
Support comes from the Wild Center, featuring Wild Walk, a high line for the Adirondacks with treetop views from 1,000 feet of bridges in a living forest. Wildcenter.org for details. Noble Home, Shelburne Falls, Massachusetts. Custom-designed panelized house kits featuring eco-friendly passive and solar design elements. Noble-home.net. the Lake George Land Conservancy, Bolton Landing, New York, working to permanently preserve the natural, scenic, and recreational resources of the Lake George region since 1988, lglc.org. And Harold's Ice Cream, Thorne's Marketplace, downtown Northampton, Massachusetts. Over 300 flavors of handcrafted dairy and dairy-free ice creams, cakes, hot fudge, and more. Harold's.com. Thanks again to Barbara Brobitz, Helen Giardella, and Ed Stander. Thank you for listening. Thank you for all your great calls. We'll do a science forum again soon, as soon as we've recovered from this one. Thanks to Dina Salzman for taking the calls today, our engineer Zach Malloy, our producer Jessica Blaustein Marshall. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow it's a car show. Gordon Fricke is here. Stay tuned now for a news update.